Good evening, everybody. On behalf of Dylan's and Prospect and Penguin, welcome. I hope this is a good occasion for you. It's a very good day for me because it's a day in which a fan has met a hero in the flesh. I have for years, he probably knows how many years, admired Timothy Garton Ash's writing in the various periodicals in which I've been able to come across it. I think particularly of the New York Review of Books. And I've always admired him as a writer of clarity, pith and elegance, and one who knew what he was talking about, and one who wrote, moreover, on topics of serious and enduring interest, topics which have kept under our gaze the fears and hopes and the lives, particularly of our neighbours in Europe and in Eastern Europe, neighbours with whom our lives are bound up. And reading about them has made me ask myself more than once how we would behave if we were in their circumstance. And it helps, therefore, that there is somebody who has made it his business to proceed on the basis that if Germany and Poland and Czechoslovakia and Hungary and Yugoslavia matter, then we need to know and to understand what is going on there. And in Timothy Garton Ash, we have someone who has helped us in that. Is he a journalist or a historian? The answer is that triumphantly, he is both. Carl Miller, when he had a professorship at Queen Mary College, I think, and edited the London Review of Books, or whatever, used to complain that he was hopelessly divided between two worlds and that in the university he was regarded as an irresponsible journalist and by journalists he was regarded as a boring academic. And in fact, one felt that he probably was regarded in that way in both quarters. But I do think that Timothy Garton Ash has pulled this very difficult trick of working in such a way that what he writes brings home to us very vividly what he has seen for himself and is reporting to us, but also that he is offering us insights that will last. His new book, his collection of important pieces, is called History of the Present. Here he is. He's going to take questions afterwards.
Thank you very much for that very kind introduction. You remember that de Gaulle once, when he was irritated by something Raymond Aron had written, said, "That journalist at the Sorbonne, that philosopher at Le Figaro." So I feel I'm in good company having that dilemma. It's a great pleasure to be here, sponsored by this array of blue chip institutions: Prospect, Dylan's, Penguin, the LSE, and Sir Jeremy Isaacs. One couldn't ask for more. Now, the starting point for my talk this evening is, I'm afraid, the book History of the Present, which is a collection of essays, reportage, sketches, vignette from Europe in the 1990s. And when I go back through it, I think, in a way, what's most important to me are the individual human encounters. A supper with Gorbachev, meeting Erich Honecker in prison in Berlin, an old farmer in Croatia, or the people I met in Kosovo. I rather agree with Stendhal when he said that all the truth and all the pleasure lies in the details. Well, I'm afraid this evening I'm going to have to renounce those details and pick up the broad brush and paint what journalists call the big picture. And what I'm going to try and do is just give you a sketch, a brief sketch and an interpretation of the 1990s in Europe, an interpretation that I've developed through the decade that runs through the book. And then I hope throw it open for debate, because there are many people in this room, I can see already, who know more than I do about particular aspects of the subject of Europe in the 90s. And we'll see if we can live up to Prospect's claim, which I think it still upholds. When Michael Ignatieff spoke here, there was actually a banner saying, Britain's intelligent conversation. Anyway, first the sketch. 10 years ago, tomorrow, on the 4th of June, Poland voted in the semi-free election that it agreed at its round table, the first round table of 1989. I'll never forget the quiet satisfaction of my friends as they crossed off the names of so many communist candidates, one by one, from those absurdly long ballot sheets. The result was a triumph for the opposition movement, Solidarity. Within 3 months, the country had a non-communist prime minister. Within 6 months, East Germany and Czechoslovakia had followed, where Poland and Hungary led. The Berlin Wall was no more. The Cold War was over. Soon, there was no Soviet Union either. The Central European Revolution of 1989 was an event without precedent in European history. A rapid and fundamental change of system was achieved without violence by a combination of mass civil disobedience and negotiation between government and opposition elites. It was an extraordinary creative departure from European revolutions as they had been known since 1789. The round table replaced the guillotine. It produced a model of, so to speak, non-revolutionary revolution, which would be looked to as far away as South Africa and by Aung San Suu Kyi in Burma, but also by an unknown French-trained intellectual called Ibrahim Rugova in a distant corner of Europe called Kosovo. While the main causes for communism's collapse lay inside communism itself, this was a triumph for the West, and specifically for what was still called the European Community. However ropey the EC looked from inside, and George Orwell once said, from inside everything looks worse. People behind the Iron Curtain saw the EC as a shining example of a peaceful, prosperous, integrating Europe. And this was an inspiration of their revolt. The leaders of their Velvet Revolutions would famously talk of the return to Europe. 1989 and its immediate consequences ended the short 20th century, marked by the great three-cornered battle between communism, fascism, and liberal democracy. If one thought of the history of Europe in the 20th century as a line on a graph, then it began to look like a V, descending from 1914 to the depths of barbarism in the Second World War and the Holocaust, but then slowly ascending again since 1945, first in Western Europe, then in Southern Europe, and now in Eastern Europe. A V for victory. That was the euphoric spirit in which we set out to build what was then called the New Europe. But where is it now, 10 years on? My next sentence, which I wrote yesterday, illustrates the difficulty of writing the history of the present, because I wrote, Europe is at war. Well, in light of today's news, perhaps one should rewrite and say, Europe has been at war for 10 weeks. British and German pilots have been bombing Serbia and probably are still this evening as we speak. Milosevic has driven more than 1.5 million Kosovars from their homes. Here, as before in Bosnia, we've gone right back to a kind of barbarism not seen in Europe since the late 1940s. The line which seemed to be soaring upwards in 1989 has wavered, then plummeted down again, turning the V into a kind of back-to-front italic N. Of course, the picture is not so dark all over Europe. To use two slightly pretentious but useful terms, the contrast is diachronic but also synchronic. There's a drastic contrast in time between 1989 and 1999, but there's a still more drastic contrast between what's happening in different parts of Europe at the same time. If you compare the map of Europe in 1989 and 1999, the first thing you'll notice is that there are no less than 14 new nation states on it, or 15 if you count Bosnia. So much for the end of the nation state. It was always misleading to generalize about the communist-ruled part of Europe. But it's even more dangerous to generalize about post-communist Europe. Divergence is its hallmark. Nonetheless, I think we can identify four main political areas of Europe today. Moreover, at the end of the decade, we have a fair idea of the basic direction in which three of them are heading. First, the states of Western, Northern, and much of Southern Europe are organized in what's now called a European Union, and most of them have joined in the great gamble of monetary union. EMU is a defining development for this whole area. At the moment, what since 1945 has come to be called the European Project seems to stand or fall with it. In fact, the Frankfurter Allgemeine Zeitung yesterday went so far as to say that, I quote, "the value of Europe is the value of the euro," a banker's view. Second, there's Central Europe, an area whose boundaries have always been disputed, but in its current political incarnation certainly includes the former East Germany, Poland, Hungary, the Czech Republic, Slovenia, and now again, after a painful absence, Slovakia. These countries are still riven by corruption, disillusionment, and all the pains of post-communism. One could be misled by the gleaming Western appearance of their new airports and hotels. But there's no question about their basic direction. Poland, Hungary, and the Czech Republic have joined NATO, as the former East Germany did already in 1990. They're negotiating to join the EU. They're rapidly becoming part of the West, of the first Europe. This is, with all due caveats, the great success story of the decade. The third area is the Balkans, politely called Southeastern Europe. If the progress in Central Europe has outstripped our dreams, the regress in former Yugoslavia has been worse than our worst nightmares. Here you most starkly see the great divergence of the post-communist world. 10 years ago, Belgrade was more prosperous and in many ways more open to the West than Warsaw. When I was in Belgrade last November, the city felt about 30 years behind Warsaw, and that was before the destruction caused by NATO bombing. It may be foolhardy in the middle of a war with a still quite unpredictable final outcome to suggest that here too we can glimpse the basic direction of development, but I will suggest that. What we see in the former Yugoslavia is a bloody separating out into new nation states with clear ethnic majorities. What's happened here in the 1990s is what happened in Central Europe in the 1940s. As Ernest Gellner memorably put it, thinking of the pre-war ethnic maps with their different colors for different ethnic groups, the picture by Kokoschka becomes a picture by Modigliani, instead of all those colors mixed up in an expressionist mess, clear, separated patches of single color. And the artist's tools are the same: war and ethnic cleansing. This process is nearly complete. In Bosnia, the new Habsburg governor, Carlos Westendorp, presides over a reality of ethnic separation. And the hard truth is that in Kosovo, an international protectorate will almost certainly preside over an essentially Albanian entity, or another de facto partition. Then only Macedonia will be a genuinely multi-ethnic state, and a very fragile one. The fourth major political area of Europe is the former Soviet Union. Here it seems to me the least is clear. Can we say with any confidence what even the basic shape and direction of Russia, Ukraine, and Belarus will be? Will they survive as integral states? Will they be democracies or dictatorships? Are they heading west or east or anywhere? We still don't know, and history of the present has to accept its limitations. I said that I'd paint with a broad brush, and of course there are many important borderline cases. The Baltic states, spatchcocked between Scandinavia, Central Europe, and the rest of the former Soviet Union. Romania, still a genuine multi-ethnic state, perilously balanced between Central Europe and the Balkans. But this is the big picture. It's a picture full of synchronic contrast, and the most acute today is obviously between the First and Third Europes, between Western Europe and the Balkans, between EMU and ethnic cleansing. German theatre directors, such as Peter Stein, have developed a kind of production they call Simultantheater, simultaneous theatre. Several different, apparently unrelated actions take place on different parts of the stage at the same time. In one corner, a husband and wife are having an argument. In another, a couple is dancing. A blind man delivers a monologue from a balcony above. The challenge is to follow them all and to work out how they're related. That's Europe today. I'm hardly the first to point out that the so-called information revolution means that we watch all these events in real time on CNN, BBC World and Sky as on a single stage. And then, of course, there's the mobile phone. As I sat last month with General Mike Jackson, the NATO commander in Macedonia, in his Skopje headquarters, talking about the military possibilities of going into Kosovo and the lessons he and his German comrades in arms were learning from studying the Second World War, my mobile phone rang. "It's the BBC here," said a voice. "We were wondering if you'd like to take part in a discussion at the LSE about monetary union." Surreal. 2 weeks later, it rang again as I stood in Pré-à-manger in Oxford, munching a flapjack. It was the wife of a leading Kosovar editor, Veton Suroy, desperately asking if we could do anything for her husband, who's still in hiding, underground, somewhere in Kosovo. This simultaneous theatre, with its intense juxtaposition of modernity and barbarity, of EMU and ethnic cleansings, poses in the first place a moral challenge. During the Third Reich, Bertolt Brecht wrote that there are times when even a conversation about trees is almost a crime, because it implies being silent about so many horrors. Now, you may object that the whole world is now a simultaneous theatre. The genocide in Rwanda was brought into our living rooms just as Kosovo is. So if we took Brecht seriously, we'd never get to talk about trees. This brings us to the important but tricky statement that what's happening in Kosovo matters particularly because it's happening in Europe. What do we mean when we say this? What we're emphatically not saying, I trust, is that white European lives are intrinsically more precious than black African lives. But then what is being said? Well, perhaps that Europe is also a moral community, not as strong as a nation, let alone as a family, but still something stronger than the moral community of all humankind. And also, quite simply, that it's closer to us. Duties are related to distance. Being closer to us, it also more directly affects our interests, whether in the form of refugees, when we take any, the impact on our trade, European security, and so on. You might also object from a different angle that Europe has always been a simultaneous theater. This is true in a way, although even 10 years ago, the other stages were much less visible, hidden as they were behind the Iron Curtain. But those of us who traveled regularly behind the Iron Curtain had the same experience that one has today, the experience of time travel. Flying to Poland under martial law, I noted in my diary, just 2.5 hours from peace to war. Departure time, 1983. Arrival, 1945. The difference between then and now is this. Then, before 1989, there was a clear limit to what we could do in or for the other side. That limit was defined by a superpower with nuclear weapons controlling half of Europe. Now no longer. The objective correlation of forces, to use an old Soviet phrase, permits almost unlimited Western intervention. Serbia is not a superpower. Milosevic has no nuclear weapons. This objective possibility of decisive influence changes the moral quality of what we do or don't do. So the jarring proximity of EMU and ethnic cleansing is a defining feature of our brave new Europe, a moral challenge and a political one. But we have also to pose the question, like the puzzled visitor to Peter Stein's simultaneous theater, whether there's any connection between these apparently unrelated actions, between, as it were, the bankers in Frankfurt and the butchers in Kosovo. I think there is. What's more, I believe it's a causal connection. Let me explain. There are, I suppose, two usual sorts of objection to EMU. There are those of principle about the loss of sovereignty, democratic control, and so on, and those of practicality. That there's not sufficient real convergence between the participating economies, that a one-size-fits-all interest rate will therefore result in growing tensions, as it helps some countries but harms others, especially when they face what economists call asymmetric shocks. I share a little of the first kind of concern, mainly about a possible loss of democratic control, and much more of the second. In less than 6 months of the single currency, we already have evidence of the strains likely to arise with a one-size-fits-all interest rate, inflation threatening in Ireland and Spain, while the performances of even the core economies of France and Germany diverge. But this I can only judge as an informed citizen, a non-economist, choosing between the dazzling but incompatible assertions of rival economists. Since so much has been invested in EMU, economically, politically, psychologically, I want it to succeed, but I fear it may have been a bridge too far, or at least too fast. My main objection to EMU, however, is a quite different one, much less frequently aired in the British debate. This is that even if monetary union is right in principle and feasible in practice, it was the wrong priority for the 1990s. In fact, my central argument tonight is that the leaders of Western Europe set the wrong priorities at the end of the Cold War. Instead of seizing the opportunities and preparing to confront the dangers that would arise from the end of communism in half of Europe, they set about trying to perfect the internal arrangements of an already well-functioning, peaceful and prosperous community of states in Western Europe. We were like people who for 40 years had lived in a large ramshackle house divided down the middle by a concrete wall. In the Western half, we had rebuilt, mended the roof, knocked several rooms together, redecorated and installed new plumbing and electric wiring, while the eastern half fell into a state of dangerous decay. Then the wall came down. What did we do? We decided that what the whole house needed most urgently was a superb new computer-controlled system of air conditioning in the western half. While we prepared to install it, the eastern half of the house began to fall apart and even to catch fire. We fiddled in Maastricht while Sarajevo began to burn. Now, of course, I can't prove the causal connection that I'm suggesting. You can never prove what would have happened if. But let's make a thought experiment. Let's suppose that after the wall came down, the leaders of the European community had concentrated all their efforts on responding to the challenge in the East. They launched something like a Marshall Plan for the transformation of the post-communist economies. They supported the build-up of civil society, political parties and independent media on a large scale, including, for example, the amazing piece of peaceful Albanian self-organization led by Ibrahim Rugova in Kosovo in the early 1990s. They began the specific reforms of the EC's decision-making and budgets that would obviously be necessary for a rapid enlargement, slim down the CAP, change the way commissioners were appointed, streamline decision-making in the Council of Ministers. They moved towards a closer coordination of foreign and security policies, appointing early in 1990 a single EC foreign policy representative. Recognizing that post-communist nationalisms could lead to armed conflict, they used the post-war Cold War restructuring of armed forces to build up a substantial rapid reaction force, having full compatibility of equipment and joint training with each other and with NATO, a common army rather than a common currency. Needless to say, when Milosevic's forces besieged Vukovar 2 months before the planned Maastricht EC summit of December 1991, they took decisive action to stop him, with the approval of then-President Gorbachev and a UN mandate. The Maastricht meeting was then devoted to what to do about former Yugoslavia, European foreign and defense policy, and preparations for eastward enlargement. Of course, I'm not suggesting that this would have solved everything. The problem of how to turn poor, undemocratic, multi-ethnic states into stable, democratic ones without bloodshed or the tyranny of an ethnic majority would have remained intractable. But if West European leaders and officials had devoted to these matters even half the vast amount of time and energy that they expended on Maastricht and monetary union, we would surely be in a better position today. Who can seriously doubt it? And Kosovo gives the lie to those who suggest that none of these difficulties could really have been foreseen. In History of the Present, I've compiled a detailed chronology linking the essays and reportage, and one of the very first entries reads, January to February 1990, Albanians in Kosovo protest against their province being stripped of its autonomy by Slobodan Milosevic. The Kosovo crisis was already there. And incidentally, talking of priorities and timescales, would it really have done so much harm to have worked for another 10 years to achieve a solid convergence between the economies and the single market before deciding whether to complete it with a single currency? Now, this is not just a historian's abstract hypothetical, such as what if the steam engine had never been invented, or what if Oliver Cromwell had been a woman. It describes a real policy alternative available at the time. Of course, there's an element here of being wise after the event, the historian's privilege. But not only. Some of us were urging at least some of this already at the time. Now, some people make a slightly different case. They would say that the problem was not so much that we gave priority to the internal perfecting of Western Europe as against Central Europe, the Balkans, and the former Soviet Union, but that we privileged Central Europe as against the Balkans and the former Soviet Union. A version of this case comes from Samuel Huntington. And I'm worried by the way in which the concept of Central Europe has been pressed into the service of what I call vulgar Huntingtonism, by analogy with vulgar Marxism. Vulgar Huntingtonism, that is the idea that the political outcomes in post-communist Europe are culturally predetermined. If you had Western Christianity, the Renaissance, the Austro-Hungarian Empire, Baroque architecture, and coffee with Schlagobers, you are predestined for democracy. Orthodox Christianity or Islam, the Russian or Ottoman empires, minarets and Burek, doomed to dictatorship. This is simply not true, either way. A more positive version of the case that what we did in the 1990s was to bring Central Europe safely into port has been advanced by another well-known American political scientist, William Jefferson Clinton, in a recent article in the International Herald Tribune, surreally entitled, On Track in Kosovo Towards Balkan Renaissance. It deserves some kind of a prize, that title. Clinton writes, I quote, "The European Union and the United States must do for Southeastern Europe what we did for Western Europe after World War II and for Central Europe after the Cold War," unquote. Well, I'm not entirely clear what the European Union did for Western Europe after World War II, since it didn't then exist, but I'm certainly clear what it didn't do for Central Europe after the Cold War. What it didn't do was precisely what the United States did do for Western Europe after 1945, a massive program for reconstruction, help for self-help. Of course, it would be wrong to suggest that nothing was done. There were fair tempers and all the rest. And certainly what's been called the passive leverage of the EU. If you, Poland or Hungary, do X, Y, and Z, you may get in, was an important positive factor in the domestic politics of Central European countries. But this was precisely passive leverage, linked with some very active meanness when it came to imports of Hungarian tomatoes or Czech widgets. The truth is that the Central Europeans did the job for themselves, making a reconstruction far more complex and difficult than that of Western Europe after 1945. The situation in early 1990 was best summed up, as so often in that part of the world, in a joke. And the joke went, "The communists have shown us how to turn an aquarium into fish soup. The question is, can you turn fish soup back into an aquarium?" In Central Europe, they have. A rather odd aquarium, to be sure, but the same could be said of the political and economic system in several countries of what we call normal Europe. The EU's role in the whole Central European transformation comes uncomfortably close to Dr. Johnson's definition of a patron. Is not a patron, my lord, one who looks with unconcern on a man struggling for life in the water and, when he has reached ground, encumbers him with help. Once again, the comparison with the United States is unfavorable. For in the second half of the decade, it was the American-led NATO which pressed ahead with eastward enlargement, while the EU fussed and dawdled, reserving its visionary leadership and decisive action for the project of monetary union. This brings us back to the question, why the leaders of Western Europe set the wrong priorities after 1989. Now, one thing this was not is the usual chronic flaw of policy making in democracies, short-termism, as politicians follow the latest opinion poll rather than leading. To be sure, in continental Europe, there was what's been called a permissive consensus for further steps of integration. But monetary union was hardly a popular cause, least of all in Germany. To turn it into reality did require bold statesmanship, putting the long term before the short term, and finally creating a fragile majority by convincing the Germans that it was simply inevitable, that Helmut Kohl was, as it were, history on horseback. So why did these statesmen choose this course? Well, of course, the project was already to hand. The Delors Report on Economic and Monetary Union was presented in April 1989, and there was a certain momentum behind it in the Council of the EC. But the decisive impulse came from one particular aspect of the end of the Cold War, German unification. President Mitterrand and the formidable French political and administrative elite, those super-smooth products of the Grande École, were already committed to trying to regain control of their own currency and to tie Germany still more closely to France by monetary union. But the sudden prospect of Germany becoming larger, more eastern, fully sovereign, gave it a new urgency. Having initially tried to slow down German unification, which he viewed with quite as much alarm as Mrs. Thatcher, François Mitterrand turned round and agreed for a price. The price was nicely summed up by a German wit. The deal, he said, was half the Deutschmark for Mitterrand, the whole of Deutschland for Kohl. And if you look at the documents which, on instructions from Helmut Kohl, have now been released by the German government, that interpretation is quite strongly supported. Yet this was a price that Kohl was quite ready to pay, although he did insist there should be something described as a political union to complement the economic and monetary one. Kohl, as Adenauer's grandson, wanted to see Germany tied firmly to the European mast, like Odysseus, so it would resist the siren calls of the country's terrible past. In a conversation I had with Helmut Kohl in 1992, soon after Maastricht, he delivered, I think, one of the most breathtaking remarks I've ever heard. At one point in the conversation, he suddenly said, "You do realize, don't you, that you're sitting opposite the direct successor to Adolf Hitler?" I was slightly taken aback. Sort of muttered something like, sort of, "My dear man, don't take it so hard." And he said, "No, no, I wouldn't deny, would I, that the last Chancellor of United Germany before him had been Herr Adolf Hitler." Well, if I'd been quick enough, I would have said, actually, it was Great Admiral Dönitz. But I didn't think of that at the time, being slightly gobsmacked. And then, of course, he went on to explain what he meant, which was that he was conscious of this historical responsibility, and whereas Hitler had proposed to put a German roof over Europe, he, Helmut Kohl, would put a European roof over Germany. It seems to me that so much of what has happened in Europe in the 1990s flows from this moment in 1990, when two individual statesmen reached an understanding based on their historically informed judgments of their country's long-term national interests. It was another example of the importance of individuals in history. Of course, there were several supporting reasons for their choice, not just Kohl and Mitterrand, but Delors, Andreotti, remember him, and other EC leaders subscribed to the classic view of European integration proceeding through economic means to political ends. That's how it had been done since the early 1950s. Why shouldn't it work again? They also believed that a core of states proceeding with further integration would exercise a magnetic attraction on their neighbours, notably on Britain, of course, but also on those in Central and Eastern Europe. It had worked before. Why not again? It didn't seem to occur to them that a process that had worked almost with the regularity of a physics demonstration in the cool, controlled laboratory of Western Europe in the Cold War might not necessarily work the same way in the raw, fresh air of the larger post-Cold War Europe. Altogether, they subscribe to what I call the Whig interpretation of European history, the kind of interpretation that you find in Jean-Baptiste de Rossel's Europe, A History of Its Peoples, published in 1990 in several European languages. A charming story of progress to peace, prosperity, and ever closer union. It's a pity they didn't read Marc Mazur's fine history of 20th century Europe with its telling title, Dark Continent. Then it hadn't been published yet. The irony is that they were confirmed in this mythopoeic, even fairy tale view of the story of 20th century Europe by the new Central and East European leaders. From Václav Havel to Mikhail Gorbachev, these leaders all said, yes, yours is the true, the modern, the normal Europe, and we want to return to it. This rose-tinted outsider's view of the European community had itself been a cause of 1989 and now contributed to the subsequent mistake. Indeed, one could go further and wonder whether the trouble with the Velvet Revolutions was actually that they were too velvet, too gentle, too peaceful. It's a rather horrible thought. But perhaps West European leaders needed a more violent challenge to provoke an adequate response. In the event, they completely underestimated the destructive power of the forces that were to manifest themselves after the end of communism. Now, it's often said that these destructive forces were buried under communism or re-emerged after 1989. Balkan nationalisms are reduced to ancient tribal hatreds, the Robert Kaplan interpretation, much favored by President Clinton. But this is quite wrong. Nationalism was mutated, not eliminated, under communism, and then it was deliberately exploited by communist rulers in the last decades of their rule. Milosevic is a post-communist politician who has used nationalism to gain and retain power for himself. I recently heard the former Hungarian dissident Gabor Demski, now mayor of Budapest, say that NATO was formed to fight the communists and is still doing so in Kosovo. An exaggeration, of course, but with a grain of truth. Some of our West European leaders apparently thought this anachronistic ancient history could all be sorted out by a little dose of EC arbitration. And so we had the supremely ludicrous spectacle of Monsieur Jacques Pousse going with an EC Troika delegation to Belgrade in June 1991, telling the Yugoslavs that small states in Europe have no future. This from the foreign minister of Luxembourg. And then declaring that the hour of Europe has come. One of the truly emblematic moments of the decade. Finally, of course, and quite simply, they were West European leaders. With very few exceptions, such as Hans-Dietrich Genscher, their whole formation and life experience was in Western Europe. Helmut Kohl once said that he regarded the city of Mainz as being at the center of Europe. In this, they were quite typical of their peoples. The Hungarian writer Georgi Konrad wrote in the 1980s that most West Europeans lived with their backs to the Berlin Wall. But this attitude built on a far older tradition of regarding Central and especially Eastern and Southeastern Europe as not really part of the proper Europe. I'm not sure how far this has really changed after 10 years in a supposedly undivided Europe. Let me give one tiny illustration. On the 25th of March this year, as the NATO bombing of Serbia started, British newspapers led with headlines saying, "War in Europe." And the rubric has persisted in several papers. Well, actually, there had been war in Europe since 1991, on and off for nearly 8 years, with perhaps 250,000 people killed and more than 2 million already driven out of their homes. But it only became war in Europe when our boys were off to fight in it. There are many ironies in this story that I've tried to tell. Helmut Kohl argued repeatedly that the cause of European integration, and specifically the Maastricht process, with monetary union at its core, was, and I quote, "a question of war and peace. By clear implication, we needed the euro to stop us fighting each other again." Why on earth stable, mature liberal democracies already closely entwined in the European Community and other institutions of bourgeois internationalism, notably NATO, should want to go to war with each other was not entirely clear. Nor was it clear how a common currency would stop them if they wanted to. While EMU was being prepared, no less than three European federations with common currencies fell apart. The Soviet Union, Yugoslavia, and Czechoslovakia, two of them with accompanying bloodshed. Then, within 3 months of the euro being launched, we were directly involved in a war in Europe. And the final irony, the euro, not yet in your pocket, was worth about 70p at its launch in January. It's worth about 65p today, perhaps slightly less. One of the reasons given for its weakness is the market's fears about the war in Europe. So not only has the euro not prevented war in Europe, it has become one of its first casualties. The future of a monetary union is indeed a question of war and peace, but not quite as Kohl intended. So there, ladies and gentlemen, is my description and my interpretation. I look forward to questions about anything from Europe in the 1990s, about Kosovo, about Germany, to comments and to alternative interpretations. But let me end with a couple of speculative remarks. One or two writers have gone a step further and argued that monetary union itself brings an increased danger of war between participating countries. While I wouldn't underestimate the tensions it may cause, this seems to me far-fetched. If the worst comes to the worst, EMU will simply break up, as currencies have before. If the Czechs and Slovaks, amidst all the nationalist hysteria of post-communism, were capable of a velvet divorce, surely the French and Germans would be. But the question is, what would then remain of the EU and the sense of a European project that sustains it? As I said at the outset, at the moment that project seems to stand or fall with EMU. The value of Europe is the value of the euro. That's why it's so important that the EU has some other major undertakings as well. Things like, well, eastward enlargement, foreign and security policy, a common defence force. Today, as I speak, EU leaders are meeting in Cologne. And when they've heard President Ahtisaari's report from Belgrade, we're told they'll agree arrangements for a common defence policy, an EU peacekeeping force, and a single security and foreign policy representative, Mr. Solana, currently of NATO. I wonder if he'll take Jamie Shea with him. Well, it's all 10 years late, but you may say better late than never. Now, plainly, the war has been a catalyst for this process. I suggested earlier that in an awful way, the trouble with what happened 10 years ago in 1989 was that it was too gentle, too civilized to provide the necessary stimulus. I'm reluctant to follow the thought through to its logical conclusion. But the ancient Greeks were less squeamish. The philosopher Heraclitus famously said that war is the father of all things. The European Union, as we know it today, is still the child of the Second World War and the lessons people drew from it. If any good thing comes of this war, perhaps it will be that it makes us do at the end of the decade what we should have done at the beginning, to start building a liberal order for the whole of Europe. But knowing Europe, I wouldn't count on it. Thank you.
Well, that was marvellously rich and meaty stuff, and I thought brilliant. I think you did too. Questions now, please. There are microphones available. If you identify yourself as someone who wants to ask a question, we'll try and get a microphone to you. Timothy Garton Ash invited alternative interpretations of the last decade and the present. Not sure there's much time for that, and I'd much rather take questions if you have any, and it doesn't do any harm, and it's rather helpful if you say who you are as you ask it. Who's first? George Walden.
Just taking you up on that last positive hint you gave, after the Berlin Wall went up, I remember a joke in Russia, which was that the situation's terrible, is there going to be a war? And the answer was, no, but there'll be such a hell of a fight for peace, there won't be a stone left standing. Now, you said that possibly something good could come of this, and the question is, we know the obvious downsides with Russia, particularly with what might one term the sort of old believers in Russia, so to speak. Is it possible that this experience, like the Cuba crisis, which shocked East and West into a sort of sobriety almost, is it possible that something good could come of this in terms of working with the Russians, particularly since we're going to work with them on the ground in Kosovo? Thank you.
Well, I think it's a very interesting question, and certainly the change in Russian policy between the beginning of the war and now is extraordinarily encouraging. But I would still be extremely skeptical, because I still believe that what Milosevic is trying for is a de facto partition of Kosovo, which would be achieved by having Russian and other Orthodox brothers in the northern part of Kosovo. I still think that's what he's trying for. I would want to see the small print of the agreement and the reality of the agreement before passing judgment. And that situation would actually be a source of constant tension and difficulty between us and the Russians. So that's what I would watch out for.
At the back.
Christopher Bowman. I've been working at the European Bank for Reconstruction and development since 1991, partly inspired by Tim's early writings. And it causes me to disagree perhaps with one twist in the argument that the Central European development has been too smooth and velvet. It seems to me that 60 to 70 million people have been able to develop towards a peaceful Europe and a mostly more prosperous Europe without the traumas and hassles we are talking about here, and that it may have been quite a good thing that they were not overwhelmed by Marshall Plan aid and did it, as you said, largely themselves, with some meannesses from us, but also some open markets. Now, my question here is, if we take two of the countries which aren't so directly concerned by Kosovo, but are indirectly concerned, Romania and Bulgaria, which are two of the unsolved problems, how would you apply the logic of the argument to ensure they, to intervene more effectively, if you want more things to happen, without them becoming a kind of dependent states, which it would appear that parts of the former Yugoslavia will have to become?
Yeah, I don't think the Velvet Revolutions were bad for Central Europe. I think you remember the marvelous comment that Adam Michnik made in 1989 when they were talking about what kind of a revolution to make, and he said those who start by storming Bastille will end up building their own. In other words, the means you use actually condition and shape the ends. And I think one of the reasons that Central Europe has done so well is precisely that they did have peaceful negotiated revolutions, by contrast with Romania or Yugoslavia or wherever. So I don't think it was bad for them. My argument was that it was bad for the West's attitude to the rest of Europe. That was the point I was trying to make. As for what to do about Romania and Bulgaria, I don't share the view that, you know, we should now completely change the priorities of EU enlargement and say, because you're in this strategically vulnerable and important position, you should immediately, you know, be hurried into the EU. I don't think we should abandon the criteria that we had and the incentives that we had. So what I think we have to do is to give them some sort of security guarantees and have a very sort of inventive kind of associate membership, which is different from what we've done before and which encourages, you know, the right sort of changes in those countries, you know, without compromising the criteria that we have for EU enlargement.
Down here.
Geoffrey Hosking, School of Slavonic Studies. You identified EMU as a false priority, but I was struck that you didn't identify NATO eastward enlargement as necessarily a false priority, which was an interesting way round to put it. Now that NATO enlargement has taken place, how do you think we can best bind, integrate Russia into the security of Europe? I imagine you'd agree that long-term security in the Balkans and in Europe in general is inconceivable without active Russian involvement. What's the best way to secure that now that NATO enlargement has taken place?
Well, Geoffrey, I think you're better equipped to answer that question than I am. But I'm not sure that anyone has a very good answer to that question. I mean, I certainly don't think that NATO enlargement was the wrong priority. I think it was absolutely the right priority. And I'm very glad that we got on with it. And I think that we should not stop there. I think that there should be further rounds of NATO enlargement. And that is, as I was saying in answer to Christopher Bem, that is one of the things that we have to offer Romania and Bulgaria. And that experience showed that, in a way, you can prepare for that much, much faster than you can for the EU. You know, we already have a treaty understanding on security matters with Russia. And clearly we should build on that. And clearly we are trying to, Stroke Talbot is trying every day to build them into the international diplomacy of the Balkans and other areas of peacekeeping. It does seem to me that you do have to have a minimum of structures, in usable structure in place, before you can talk about a Marshall Plan or large-scale economic assistance. And it seems to me that one has not got that in place in Russia, and so I don't see that as a way to go. You know, those are only elements of an answer, but I don't really have one. As I said, I think I can tell you about three areas of Europe, and I can tell you what I think is happening and what should happen. I don't have an answer for the former Soviet Union.
You, sir, at the back.
David Haney. I was fascinated by your analysis, but I did, I must say, find that you didn't establish very clearly a causal link between the failure to make the right choices about Central and Eastern Europe and security and EMU. And I don't really think they do stand up very well if you try to push them, but I'd be interested to hear a little bit more about the causal link, particularly since I did think you were astonishingly kind to the United States, who didn't have an alternative priority, namely EMU, which was preoccupying them, but was even more backward in coming forward to deal with the problems in the Balkans than were the Europeans, and who provided far less funds for the Central and East Europeans in investment and aid than the Europeans did.
Well, if I may say so, I half expected that you might say that. And I don't think I will convince you. because it is the nature of the argument, what would have happened if, you know, that there is no hard evidence that one can produce. I mean, there is no, you know, causal link, as there is even establishing the origins of the Second World War, or why the apple fell from the tree. I mean, that is obviously the case. So if I haven't convinced you with what I said, I'm sorry. But you know, my fundamental point, to repeat it, is in a way a very simple one, which is, you know, I do not, if even a fraction of the political will, bureaucratic energy, time had been devoted to the problems of the other Europe, and notably of the Balkans, over these 10 years, it was devoted to the preparation of EMU, surely we could have done a little better. And it seems to me, you know, hard to disagree with that simple proposition. And, you know, why is it only now, only today in Cologne as we speak, that things are being done that should have been done and could have been done, if not 10 years ago, certainly 5 years ago? So that's my essential argument. Now, as to being kind to the United States, a grave charge, I'm certainly not going to defend the administration of William Jefferson Clinton, which is certainly not one of the great administrations of American history, and certainly not on the Balkans, where, indeed, he did the opposite of, was it Theodore Roosevelt? You know, talk softly but carry a big stick, and they talked loudly and carried a small stick. So I think they had a lousy policy, but I think it is also true to say that in 1991, we in Europe did say, through the marvelous person of Monsieur Jacques Pousse, but not only him, you know, this is our business, we are the new Europe, we will deal with this one. And so we did actually encourage Jim Baker to make his famous remark, we have no dog in this fight. And anyway, I actually think that it is Europe's business in the first place. This is in Europe. If there were ethnic cleansing going on in Mexico, we would not expect Germany and France and Britain to be called on to sort it out. I think it's actually shaming that it's still the United States which has to come in and sort out Kosovo.
At the front, down here, please.
John Hewam, just taking up on that last point, do you believe that for the foreseeable future that Europe will have this relationship, particularly in defence terms, with the United States? I just wondered how you felt how NATO was evolving from its original aim as essentially a bulwark against the Soviet Union to a nominal peacekeeping force. And I have to say, one who is broadly sympathetic to what has happened in the last 2 months, I would then immediately have to concede that the original purpose, namely to prevent Serb aggression, far from succeeding, appears to have backfired. There seems to be, frankly, a chronic lack of thought in this matter.
Well, I'm not sure if that's a question about Europe and NATO or a question specifically about Kosovo, but I think that, I mean, first of all, this is an obvious statement, we will always need the United States for European security and certainly for dealing with crises outside Europe. I mean, that's absolutely clear. But I think that what Kosovo also illustrated was the limits of possible relying on the United States. One very simple union that it's, I don't think there's, it's always dangerous to say one can't think of an example in history because then someone in the audience thinks of one. But I can't think of an example in history of a superpower with such a unique position of predominance which is not prepared to risk a single soldier in armed combat and therefore conduct the war from 15,000 feet, often against
the civilian infrastructure because it can't find the Serb soldiery in Kosovo. And it seems to me that that is something, you know, we have to face up to. This is the kind of superpower to which we are allied. And unless that is going to change dramatically in American politics, in American opinion, and I see no sign of that, then that is for me a compelling argument for having a really coherent European force, European rapid reaction force of the kind we're just beginning to talk about, which, you know, with NATO, American support and intelligence and so on and so forth, will be able to act in a peacemaking and peacemaking role in Europe.
Henrietta Foster, just in front of you, and then this gentleman down here.
I'm sorry to say this after Sir David Hannay, but I can't seriously imagine that you can believe that there is anyone in DG1 in Belgium, or indeed at the UN, who was competent in 1991 to make serious European security union as opposed to kind of monetary union. I've worked for both of those institutions, and the caliber of the people working there was not really desperately impressive. And to add to that, don't you think that with an era where presidential politics in the United States is based solely on foreign policy, the only power is foreign policy and not domestic policy, and with the Blair government making that very clear, the agenda for British government and the sort of degrading of the civil service and listening to civil servants, that we don't really have any competence to make those decisions about Kosovo, that is, in fact, we're living in such a kind of media-spun era that those eras, that we are losing the essence of diplomacy and the essence of European Union.
Well, I'm surprised you think foreign policy is, if I understood you correctly, predominant in the United States. I seem to remember someone, one of the presidential candidates, saying something about the economy is stupid, you know, in answer to a question. I'm not saying that to you, I hate to add, but in answer to somebody's question. I mean, I would have thought it's the case that actually since the end of the Cold War, it's a domestic agenda which has been predominant in American politics. Now, I wouldn't dream of commenting on the quality of the personnel of DG1, but it is not the business of DG1, you know, to make European policy at the end of the Cold War. What I'm talking about are the major states of Western Europe and their governments. And certainly, you know, the foreign offices of Germany, Britain and France had people who knew a good deal about these areas, and indeed the military would have been capable of coming up. I mean, all these things, not that these things were not recognized and discussed at the time, they were discussed. It's simply that they did not become the priority of the political leaders for reasons I've tried to explain.
I'm going to take three more questions only, here, there, and Sam Britton.
Bernard Herrmann, you have chosen to define the easternmost boundary of Eastern Europe at the border of the ex-Soviet Union. Whilst in your excellent lecture you referred in passing to Western Ukraine and the Baltic states, I'd be grateful if you'd elaborate upon the fate of these countries further, because in the case of the Baltic states, you have relatively high levels of socioeconomic development, and countries which, certainly in the case of Latvia and Estonia, wish to regard themselves as being European, but where, in certainly in the case of Latvia, 45% of the population are Russian. Would you care to comment upon this situation and the situation also prevailing in the Western Ukraine in the area of Lviv?
I'm prepared to comment after a point, Lord Capo, you know. Look, just to get one thing clear. One thing I've learned in some years of discussions about Europe is a very important rule is never name an eastern frontier of Europe. And I certainly didn't name an eastern frontier of Europe. And most certainly did not put it on the western frontier of the former Soviet Union. I mean, you know, working definition Atlantic to Europe, that's fine. And I think it's a great mistake made by Helmut Kohl and others, other West European leaders, to say never to Russia as a member of the European community. I would never say never. Russia is a partly European country. Why should Russia be excluded on this basis? I see no basis. So that's the first point. And now I think, honestly, I could say some things about Ukraine, but I think I will pass on those. I think that the problem that we will face in the foreseeable future is an intriguing little one. And if I were advising someone where to go in the next couple of years, I would say go to Kaliningrad, because it seems to me that the Baltic states are making impressive progress. Estonia is already part of the negotiation, and in 5 to 10 years' time, we will be wondering what to do with this little piece of Russia, which is now, you know, crooked in the elbow of the European Union.
My name is Lutz Kleverman, and I study history at the LSE. Whenever something goes wrong in anywhere in the world, basically, especially in Eastern Europe, then West Europeans start doing this mea culpa game, and I'm really not sure if we do not overestimate our influence or the Western influence, or whether that doesn't express a certain patronizing attitude towards the East. And the other thing I'm not sure about your argumentation is that there really is this dilemma between EMU and a Marshall Plan in the East. I think there's a bit of a false dilemma here. I don't think there was really a zero-sum game. Why not do this with one hand and do the other thing with the other hand? But then the real question that I have is, why would it really have been in the interest of the West European leaders to engage in a Marshall Plan? If we compare the American motivations in 1947 and the West European motivations in 1991 onwards, you know, why really was it in the Western interest that the Eastern countries would become rich, that they wouldn't start killing each other? Why not just not give a shit?
Well, I'm also anticipating that question. What business is it of ours? Are you from Germany?
No. I'm German. German European.
You're German European.
European region of Germany.
But, you know, a country which has taken, if I remember rightly, 420,000 Bosnian refugees, and is now taking a very large number of Kosovo refugees, would have at least one answer to that question, which is, you know, it does affect us very directly. Because, you know, if there aren't conditions for decent life there, they'll come here. And Germany, above all, is affected, you know, very directly. But not only Germany. I mean, I could understand how you might have made that argument in 1991 or 92 or 93, and many people did. What interest is it about? Faraway countries would be known as. Very difficult to see how you can make that argument when the whole Western alliance has just been engaged in a war for more than 2 months over Kosovo. I mean, the fact is, this is the place, this is the area of Europe where two world wars started. You know, I won't say a third one has nearly started there, that would be an exaggeration, but we have been dragged into a European war in those parts. They have a habit of dragging us in. And that seems to me, you know, a sufficient answer to the question, what interest is it of ours?
The last question, Sam Britton.
Well, unlike some people, I completely agree with your interpretation, and I don't think it was hindsight on the part of all of us. In fact, I add a little gloss that the famous and notorious Maastricht Conference was planned in 1988-99 before the Iron Curtain came down, and the Western European statesmen did not have the imagination to rethink everything, and they let the momentum take over. This was in addition to the summit-type vision of Helmut Kohl that you reported so graphically. But what I really want to ask is a kind of question historians hate, which is, what do Western Europeans do now? It would surely make matters worse if we expended even more energy than we did in setting up this single currency, in trying to take it apart again and reestablish the franc, the Deutschmark, and so on. And wouldn't it be better to take this as water under the bridge, try to make this work as best we can, and direct our attention to the questions that you rightly emphasized? My worry about this concerns this little island, that how can we carry out this program when debate in the next 3 or 4 years will be centred on if, whether and should the UK join this monetary area. And all I can say as a so-called expert is that it's a much less important problem than people think. It will nevertheless dominate debate, and for the worst possible reasons, not a technical economic reason at all, but because British statesmen want to sit at some imagined top table.
Thank you very much. It's a very, very nice last question to have. I mean, my view, which I expressed just in passing, is exactly the one you expressed, namely, having got to this point, you know, to go back would be the idea that to go early. And we should try to make it work. We should, at least we should want it to work. And we should quite genuinely want it to work for those countries which are in it at the moment. And maybe it won't require those drastic steps to political union and sacrifices of sovereignty which stick in our gullet. Maybe it won't. Who knows? We should wait and see. But given that it is clearly such a gamble, such a high-risk enterprise, given that nothing of this kind has been done before, that successful monetary unions in the past have normally been preceded by a degree of political union, we have to have some other show in town. The EU has to be doing some other major things which would survive if EMU collapsed, because as I said, I assume that if EMU does collapse, an awful lot would collapse with it, including, notably, I fear, a great deal of the commitment to the European project from the French and the German political elites. So it's in our own, you know, definite national interest to make sure that we have those other shows in time in case it doesn't work. As for the British debate, I'm delighted to hear that you feel the way I do, which is that really, you know, one could sort of go to sleep for 3 years and wake up and come back here, and one would probably be hearing almost exactly the same argument about EMU that we've been hearing for the last 4 or 5 years with slightly different variations. But I shall certainly, when I wake up after those 3 years, look forward to reading you on it.
Ladies and gentlemen, these proceedings are nearly over, but not quite. Some of you, I believe, have been invited to a reception, which you may proceed to, way upstairs somewhere, the fifth floor, I think. All of you are invited, as you leave, to go outside, and where you will find copies of Timothy Garton Ash's book. You are invited, and who could resist after hearing his brief remarks, you are invited to purchase it, and if you bring it back in here, he will be very happy to sign it for you, and I hope several of you will do that. This has been a very remarkable evening, I think. It is clear what pains and trouble Timothy Garton Ash has taken to compose the piece that he delivered to us this evening. And I think it's been clear from your reaction and appreciation of it how much you've enjoyed it. We've also had a very high level of debate in the question and answer session that has followed. And if all debate about foreign policy in this country were conducted on that level, we would be a better governed country than we are. But what I wish principally to do is to invite you to congratulate him and to thank him for his words to you, to us here this evening. Thank you very much.